this is Allison Sheridan of the NosillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, April 10th, 2011, and this is show number 307. We have a lot of fun planned for this show. Chit-chat across the pond this week is with Kirshen of freerangecoder.com. She's a very high-ranking Nosilla castaway, a brilliant software engineer, and a lot of fun. I had a blast talking to you, and I think those make the best chit-chats, don't you? Well, anyway, let's go ahead and get started. Stefan Lesage is an official Nosilla castaway as well, but he doesn't often get to join in the live show because he's in Belgium, and the show starts at 2 a.m. for him. Stefan does a podcast called the iTutor Podcast, hosted at itutorpodcast.com. I've wanted to listen to the show before, but unfortunately it's in Dutch, so unless my purpose was to learn a new language, it wasn't really for me. Well, this week, Stefan published his first English-spoken video podcast, and he gave me a sneak preview, and it's wonderful. In this episode of the iTutor Podcast, he teaches how to effectively use keywords in Aperture. I've used keywords before, but I'm definitely not good at them. I watched Stefan's video, and now I have a bunch of ideas about how to do it faster and the benefits of creating a hierarchical structure for my keywords. I'm not sure I will take it quite to the anal level that he does, but I still think I will begin to do more hierarchy. I absolutely loved his tutorial. If you'd like to give it a watch, I put a link in the show notes to the Aperture Keyword Podcast episode over on itutorpodcast.com. Thanks for telling me about it, Stefan, and giving me the sneak preview. Pat Putnam, who's written in many times before to the show, she's contributed dumb questions, all kinds of things. She wrote me a note telling me about her experience using the iPhone for tethering. She figured it was probably old news for all of us, but it was actually a perspective I'd never heard before, because I actually haven't done tethering. I encouraged her to give the microphone a try this time and record it so you wouldn't hear me droning on and on repeating what she said. She rose to the challenge, and now we can hear her tell the story in her own voice. She does do a little whining up front that I made her do it, but I think you'll like it.
Hey, Allison. Well, here goes. This is my first attempt at recording a review, and so I hope it sounds halfway decent and you don't have to edit the heck out of it. I thought you might be interested in my experiences with the iPhone hotspot. Tethering and personal hotspots are all new to me, and I am thrilled that the experience turned out to be so simple and pleasant, so that's why I wanted to share it with you. The AT&T hotspot option was very central in my decision to get a Wi-Fi on the iPad 2, instead of the Wi-Fi plus 3G model that I had with my first iPad. So I went to the AT&T website a week or so before iPad 2 ordering was available. I found the tethering option on my wireless account, and I could swear that the cost was $20 or $25 per month, because I remember thinking that it wasn't that terrible compared to the $15 per month on the 3G iPad. I then called AT&T to ask them if I could turn that option on and off on the website for 30 days at a time, or if there was a longer contract involved. I was told that there was no contract, it could be turned on and off at will, and the charge would be just for the months it was turned on. So, armed with that information, I definitely decided to order the Wi-Fi iPad 2. This week, after having the iPad a couple weeks, I decided to turn on the tethering and try it out. Imagine my shock when the only tethering choice was 4 gigabytes at a whopping $45 per month. I called AT&T, found out that that was indeed the only option available, and that their prices had gone up over the past few weeks. But since I'd been thinking that I would have to pay that fee on top of what I was already paying monthly, I was very relieved to find out that I was actually changing from one plan to another. So what I had been paying previously, I would not be paying anymore. So the price wasn't quite as bad as I thought. Once I chose to switch, things went very smoothly. There was no wait at all for it to be implemented. I went to my iPhone settings, saw personal hotspot, and turned it on. I was prompted to turn on Wi-Fi if I wanted to use Wi-Fi enabled, or else to choose Bluetooth and USB only. I chose to turn on Wi-Fi. My iPhone immediately showed up in the list of networks under the airport symbol. in the iMac menu bar and in the list of networks in my iPad Wi-Fi settings. Typed in the Wi-Fi password that showed up on my iPhone, tried connecting with both, and they both worked smoothly and with an okay amount of speed. Next, I tried the Bluetooth and USB-only option. Following the directions in the personal hotspot window on the iPhone, I paired my iPhone with my iMac. Bluetooth pan then showed up in my System Preferences network window. In the right panel, my iPhone showed up as Device, and I simply had to click on Connect. But then realized to actually connect via Bluetooth only, I needed to turn off my AirPort. Once I had done that, my iMac connected via Bluetooth. The speed seemed quite a bit slower than via Wi-Fi. So I checked my iPhone, and I found out that it was not connected to my Microcell, and that I was actually using the Edge network and not the 3G network. I restarted my phone, made sure it was connected to the Microcell this time, connected my iMac to the internet again through Bluetooth, and it was just as fast as Wi-Fi had been. Of course, my fastest connection out here through my DSL modem is a little over 3 megabytes. So we aren't talking lightning speeds, but adequate. Probably just a little under 3 megabytes. The Bluetooth setup with my iPad was even easier than on my iMac. When I turned on Bluetooth in the settings, my iPhone appeared immediately. The code showed up on my iPhone, I clicked OK on my iPad to verify, turned off Wi-Fi, and the little tethering symbol showed up in place of the Wi-Fi symbol up in my menu. I was connected and had decent speed. The whole time I was connected in any of these ways via the iPhone hotspot, there was a kind of cool pulsing blue area across the very top of the iPhone screen that said, Personal hotspot, and then had the number of connections. So, Allison, that's my experience with the iPhone hotspot so far. I'm now looking forward to trying it out somewhere besides my house. Thanks a lot. Love your show as always.
Well, that's great to know how easy it was, Pat. That's fantastic. That really sounds like it worked out well for you. And not too expensive. Too bad they did kind of raise the price a little bit there, but certainly not as bad as some other options that I've seen in the past. So that's pretty good. I'm glad to hear that. And I'm glad you had so much fun with it. That's excellent. Thank you for sending it in. And the recording sounded fantastic. So now you have to do more. Well, I think I told you guys a while back about my friend John, who draws these amazing creatures and these kind of creepy, sad clowns, and how I made him a website over on WordPress.com. The site, by the way, is at Zamps, ZAMPS.wordpress.com. Well, I created a gallery page with thumbnails of all of his drawings, and it works great. It really looks good. The problem is when you go to add a new image, it's this really convoluted process to get them to show up in the gallery. John took matters into his own hands and tried to put 5 new drawings up on his own, and while they showed up in the image library, they didn't show up in the gallery. I knew exactly how to fix it. All I had to do was go to my own website where I posted a Screen Steps tutorial to tell him exactly how to do it the right way. I can't necessarily get him to read my tutorials, so I wrote it down for my own sanity so I, A, didn't have to remember how to do it for myself, or B, figure it out again. I simply walked through the steps I'd written, viewed the screenshots where I had put arrows and sequence numbers and all that, and I was able to follow along. It took me a long time because the process is so convoluted, like I said, but it was just a matter of following the steps and not trying to be clever and skip a step. I assume that you'd like to preserve your own sanity, and I assume you have family and friends to help you with other computer stuff too, so I really encourage you to go over to screensteps.com and buy yourself a copy of Screen Steps for $40 for the standard version or $80 for the pro version if you want to make fancy pants manuals and all that kind of stuff. You'll really enjoy making these, and your friends and family will know how brilliant you are, and they'll help you remember how to do stuff too. So last week, you might remember that I called Zumocast out for the misbehaving manner on installing Growl without permission. But you know what? I'm still going to talk about how much I like Zumocast. I did a review of Zumocast back in December on show number 289, in contrast to my previous favorite air video from InMethod.com that Donald Burr reviewed on show number 256. Now, why am I regurgitating all of this? Well, first, let me tell you what Zumocast and AirVideo do for you. One might say, what problem they solve. Both applications allow you to stream videos from your Mac or PC to your iPhone or iPad. Now, there's actually a third option now. iTunes Home Sharing is built into Snow Leopard. Normally, it's a good thing when you can use a built-in tool instead of having to go download something and install or even pay for a third-party tool. That's true if the tool gives you what you need and want, sort of like the ongoing debate between Bart and me about built-in Spotlight and third-party launchers like Alfred and LaunchBar. So let's see if either of these tools have been made obsolete or if they're still compelling applications compared to iTunes Home Sharing. With Air Video and Zumocast, you have to install an application on every Mac and PC from which you want to share videos. Those applications allow your computers to share out their video content. On Home Sharing from iTunes, it is the server, so you don't have to install an application. One big difference right off the bat here is that iTunes Home Sharing can only share out videos and audio files that live in iTunes and so must be in an Apple-approved format. In contrast, Zumocast will play MP4, AVI, MKV, DivX, Real Media video files, and a whole bunch more video formats. But that's not all. It will play audio files beyond MP3 and M4A. I tested it out on uncompressed WAV files and AIFF files, and it didn't skip a beat. But wait, that's not all. There's even more. Would you believe you can open non-video files? I was able to open PDFs, images, Word, number, and Excel files. I'm so glad I started messing with this to do the comparison because I never knew you could do all or any of this. All you do is identify what directories you want to share from your Mac or PC, and they instantly show up on your iOS device. Zumocast has built into it the ability for you to play back audio and video files and access those other kinds of documents over 3G while not on your home network. Heck, you can even view these files from any web browsers and even download them to the mobile device. Now, Air Video, on the other hand, plays only video files, no music or other types of files. But in video, it'll play AVI, DivX, MKV, MP4, and more. Now I can hear you yelling at the iPod that iOS devices can't play some of these formats, so how does that work? Well, Air Video actually transcodes the videos on the fly as they stream to your iOS devices. That's pretty cool. Air Video has an experimental tab where you can set up sharing over the internet, just like Zumocast has built in. Even though you don't have to install software to run iTunes Home Sharing, there are some steps to setting it up. Non-obvious steps to me. You have to turn on sharing in your iTunes preferences, then you have to go to Advanced and authenticate with your Apple ID to allow your content from iTunes to be shared via Home Sharing. I sure didn't figure that out on my own. I had to go hunting around for the instructions. Air Video and Zumocast have to be running as background applications on your Mac or PC in order for your iOS devices to use the media files on your computers. But they don't take up that much space and energy, you know, they don't like crank up your processors or anything like that. So I set them both as startup items since I use them pretty much every day. In contrast, the behemoth that is iTunes has to be running for you to view the content on your iOS devices using iTunes Home Sharing. That's kind of a drag, you know, because that's a big, heavy application. These other things are really, really light. All right, time to get towards the bottom line here. Zumocast is free. Air Video is $3 whole, and iTunes Home Sharing is free and built into your system. Zumocast has way more capabilities than the other two. Air Video gets you to more video file types, but it doesn't play audio. And iTunes, while it does play audio and video, only plays those formats that work in the iTunes ecosystem. At this point, I had declared Zumocast a clear winner with all of these advantages. Then I went into iTunes and get the link, and it was gone. I went to the Zumocast website at zumocast.com, where it says, Zumocast download has been temporarily disabled. Zumocast software distribution has been suspended while we make several enhancements. We're sorry for any inconveniences caused, and we're working to bring back Zumocast download as quickly as we can. Existing Zumocast users, you may continue to enjoy the service without interruption. Well, that's a big bummer. I read in the forums where David Z of the Zumo Drive team elaborated just a tad more. Although we've been acquired by Motorola Mobility, iOS will continue to be one of our supported platforms. However, as we perform upgrades on the desktop software, we didn't want to confuse new users coming in from the Apple App Store. That's why we've removed the download from the App Store temporarily. The team is working hard to perform a couple of improvements before we'll bring the app back to new users. I want to reassure folks that we're not going to drop or stop supporting Apple platforms. where fans of iOS would want to continue to see Zumo succeed on that platform. Now, I got to tell you, I was encouraged by that, and then I noticed that statement was posted on January 4th of this year, like 3 months ago. So maybe that means it's just around the corner now, and this whole review isn't just a big old bag of teas. Or it means that if it's taken this long, the lovely new owners from Motorola are stopping development. I wrote an email to the guys at Zumo earlier in the week, hoping to get a little bit of an update, telling them I was going to do this review, but they didn't write back. So aren't you really glad I did this comparison? I sure am. In any case, if any of you see an announcement that ZumoCast is back, please be sure to shoot me an email on, or a tweet right away. During that review of all the audio and home video sharing options, I typed ZumoCast, Air Video, and iTunes Home Sharing a total of 33 times collectively. Do you think I typed them all by hand? Of course not. That would be a big waste of some perfectly good carpal tunnel action. Instead, as soon as I started writing that bit, I launched Text Expander and I created short snippets for each one. Z semicolon for ZumoCast, AV semicolon for Air Video, and IHS semicolon for iTunes Home Sharing. Just think how much energy and time I saved doing that. You may think that you don't need Text Expander, but I'm certain you repeat things way more often than you think you do. You can get Text Expander for $34.95 or get a family pack for only $10 more for up to 5 computers in one household. Check it out at smilesoftware.com. And yes, I have a snippet for their website too. Well, during the after party for the live show last week, Steve brought me my birthday present about 3 weeks early. It's possible it was because I started whining at the very beginning of the show, and I whined and whined and whined because I knew it was already in the house, because I kind of had a really good feeling that he had bought me one. Anyway, it was a new MacBook Pro. I thought I should review it, especially in comparison to my 2008 MacBook Pro with the brand new SSD in it. First, we'll get the Tim the Toolman Taylor barking over with. He got me the 15-inch quad-core i7, 2.2 gigahertz with 8 gigs of RAM and the 750 gig hard drive. Sorry, I got all excited about that Core i7. Quad-core i7. Seriously. Anyway, the drive I got was only 5,400 RPMs, but I wanted the space. Plus, I knew I was going to move my SSD into the optical drive bay of the new machine after I get it all burned in. I chose the high-resolution screen on this device, which was actually kind of a tough choice for me. You see, at my advanced years, things are getting significantly more difficult to see. I actually wear contacts for distance, plus glasses over them for computer distances. But in some conditions, I can get away without the reading glasses. My friend Diane took me to the Apple store so she could buy her first Mac in about 15 years. She did it upright, walked out with a MacBook Air and a Mac Mini as a media server for a big-screen TV. Anyway, her eyesight is even worse than mine, so we batted our eyelashes till the nice salesman allowed us to yank one MacBook Pro around from the opposite side so we could see the normal res and high res side by side. The quote-unquote low res is 1400 by 900, same as my 2008 model, but the high res is a stunning 1680 by 1050. I thought the fonts looked rather small, and I even brought up Aperture, where they use about 3-point text on everything. They actually hate old people. I didn't know you knew that. But it looked really good. I was still a little bit hesitant, but Diane gave it her seal of approval, and that's all I needed. Now that I've had it for about a week, I can say without a doubt it was the right choice for me. Unlike George from Tulsa, I don't find myself smashing my nose prints on the screen. I love the high-res screen. When I flip back to my older machine, it looks like a cartoon, you know, like big, giant buttons and everything's all big and silly looking. A huge benefit I didn't think of at all is that if you listen to the Mac Review Cast, you end up with a zillion and one menu bar apps, and there's so many that some applications, when you're in them, you actually can't get to all of your menu bar items when you need them. With this wicked high-res screen, I can cram even more on than before. And that is a good thing at that, because when I turned on iStat menus so I could see my processor load, there were 8 graphs instead of the 2 I'd had before with the Intel Core 2 Duo. After some discussions with Zach and John F. Braun and Kershen, they explained to me that Intel uses virtual threads, so they show the 4 processor cores I have as 8. I think it's also called hyperthreading. I think that's the same thing. Not real sure. I'm not sure I believe in virtual threads yet, but I have really cool-looking graphs to show off now. All right, let's talk about real-world usage. First of all, ever since I got the SSD, my 2008 MacBook Pro was great for about 80% of the week. Using it for launching applications really fast off that SSD, it was fantastic. Writing emails, playing on the web, all that kind of stuff worked perfectly. I was never waiting for it. Where I felt bad for the poor thing, though, was when I take it into podcast production on Sundays. Last week, I gave you my diatribe of everything I put this thing through. You can imagine a 2.5-year-old machine might struggle just a bit. When I'm broadcasting the live show and actually recording in GarageBand, both processors were crammed to the top of the graph in the high 90th percentiles. This week, I ran a test with everything on and recording, and would you believe I had 78% of the processor power free? Seriously, it was like 95, 98% used before. Now it's 78% free. Absolutely amazing. I was trying to crank it up to the full high def resolution of Ustream Producer Pro, but it looks like it's a network bandwidth issue at that point. The Nocilla Castaway said that it was actually stuttering on the video. So I guess we can't do it. I guess I wasn't processor bound. So I ran some speed tests of the other rigor of Sunday night, all of the audio encoding operations I go through. After I finish recording the show, I have to export the AIFF file from GarageBand. The new machine did that 45% faster. Next, I run that AIFF file through an application called The Levelator. That makes all the audio sound about the same volume, even though I'm getting it from different people and mixing it together. On running the Levelator on the audio, that the new machine was 31% faster. Next up, I copy that same 700-megabyte Levelated AIFF file into iTunes, which is only tens of seconds, but the new machine was still 58% faster doing that copy. Finally, I have iTunes transcode the AIFF into an MP3, so it's small for you guys and not 700 megabytes, and that's where the new machine handily beat the old one by 56%. I averaged all of those times together, and the entire process went 40% faster on the new MacBook Pro. I'd say that's pretty good proof of a great purchase. Now, you know how I like to live on the edge. Well, one of the things that comes along with all that fun is the joy of stuff going wrong. Shortly after I got the new machine, I plugged it into my Apple Cinema Display. The Apple Cinema Display has always worked great with my older MacBook Pro using the Mini DisplayPort connector. In the newest MacBook Pro, they swapped out the Mini DisplayPort connector for the new Thunderbolt connector. If you haven't heard of that yet, Thunderbolt is a new data transfer protocol like USB or FireWire. The new protocol is supposed to get 10 gigabits per second data transfer rates. So 10 gigabits is 10,000 megabits, where USB 2.0 was 480 megabits, FireWire 800 was 800 megabits. So Thunderbolt is 12.5 times as fast as the fastest FireWire. Now, I'm really excited about this. I can't wait till I can get a backup drive that can talk Thunderbolt. That's going to be awesome. But they're not out yet. But what's weird about this is you actually use the Thunderbolt connector to plug into your Apple Cinema Display. It looks just like a DisplayPort connector. I've had people explain to me why this works, but it still seems really odd to me. So why did I bother with all that description of explaining about Thunderbolt? Well, because when I plugged my monitor into my new MacBook Pro via the Thunderbolt connector, my monitor started to flicker. It was a weird kind of flicker. The bottom one quarter of the display would suddenly just shift to one side and bounce back. It just goes and come back. It was kind of disconcerting, to say the least. Every once in a while, the entire screen goes black. That's really fun, too. It'll flicker every few minutes, and then it won't do it for hours at a time. I headed over to the forums at Apple, and I found, I don't know, like 20 people with the same issue. Only one guy specifically pointed out that shift of the bottom quarter of the screen. I made a Genius Bar appointment for Friday, since I had the day off anyway. On Thursday, I called AppleCare, figuring maybe I could spare myself that visit, but in my conversation with Katie, she told me that they didn't have record of anyone with this problem. Well, she did give me one thing to try that I never realized could work, and I'm still not sure I believe her, but she suggested that I plug in the display and then run software update. She said that with it plugged in, it would search specifically for any firmware updates associated with that display. I guess that kind of makes sense, since you often get firmware updates that somebody else wouldn't get because of the configuration of your hardware. Well, I was very excited, and I tried it, and it didn't find any firmware updates, so I decided to keep my appointment with the Genius. The night before that, though, I read in the forums that one guy had fixed it by resetting the PRAM and the system management control, or is it console, whatever, the SMC. I gave that a shot, but I still had the flickering. Off to the Genius Bar with my MacBook Pro under my arm and the display waiting in the car just in case they needed that. I wouldn't have to carry that in if I didn't need to. I sat with the genius for at least a half hour with my Mac hooked up to his 24-inch display, and not one time did that darn thing flicker. Luckily, he didn't brush me aside. He spent some time researching the problem with engineering, and they did find evidence that other people are having this problem. The good news was he said they don't believe it to be a hardware problem on the machines, but rather something a firmware update should fix in the future. In the meantime, enjoy the flicker and wait. Not ideal, but better than having to send my new baby back, you know? I handed him my podcast card, plugged the show, and I went home. I didn't get really upset by this because, you know, it's just one of those things that happens when you live on the bleeding edge. A brand new connector protocol, you can't expect perfection right out of the gate. You can hope for perfection, but you'll probably be disappointed. I remember when I bought the first, what was it? Was it the first Intel-based Mac? Or might even have been the first, might have been the titanium MacBook or whatever they were called, for the titanium PowerBook. I had two or three logic board failures in the first couple of months. So I'm kind of used to this kind of thing. Well, I got to tell you, my buddy Ron was giving me a hard time Friday night on getting this new MacBook Pro because he knew that I'd list out all the reasons that I did not need it. Of course, we know that need often has nothing to do with it. It's kind of want seems to override need in some cases. But it turns out I've actually discovered something very interesting. There were ways I was unconsciously limiting my work on the Mac. For example, you'd be hearing chit-chat across the pond later with Kirshen, and I was able to actually do video Skype with her during my audio recording. I would have never thought to try that out on the old machine, knowing the limitations of it. I gave it a whirl this time, and it was no stress on the machine at all. I found it a really cool way to do the recording. I think I was much more engaged because I was looking her right in the eye and we were just talking like a couple of people. You know, I couldn't go wander off and play a game or something while she was talking because she was looking right at me, you know? Now, a normal person would declare victory and do the show on Sunday before even thinking about moving the SSD from the old machine to the new one, right? Well, you know, that's just not how I roll. Around noon, somewhere between noon and 2 o'clock, today, I decided that was a great time to break both machines open and put the optical drive back in the old machine, put the SSD in the new machine, and then put the new optical drive in the external enclosure. I thought about looking up the instructions so I didn't make any mistakes, but you know, geez, it only been like 3 months since I did it the first time, so I just cracked them right open and got to work. It turned out to be really easy, and I did remember almost all of the steps. There was this one little bracket I forgot to move off the optical drive. It wasn't that important, but I went ahead and put it back in anyway. So with the new SSD and the new machine, I booted her up and she got stuck on the gray Apple logo. I looked online for possible solutions to this and I got the answer that I should reset the PRAM, holding down Command, Option, P, R, and Power all at once. And that'll give you a horrific hand cramp if you've ever tried to do that. The new machine booted right up into the hard drive instead of the SSD. I tried switching back to the SSD again, same problem. So then I headed over to the OWC live chat. I mean, if you haven't been to Otherworld Computing to buy something, you've just missed something because these guys are fantastic. The live chat, they've always helped me out. They're fantastic. Anyway, my little friend Chris explained to me that this will never work what I'm trying to do. The OS that I installed on the solid state drive would not have the right drivers for the new machine because I did it when it was plugged into the old machine. I actually didn't realize it did it specialize like that. Guess that makes sense, though, huh? Well, at first I was thinking that I'd have to install Leopard, then run the Snow Leopard upgrade disk, and then install the Mammoth 10.6.7 combo update until I remembered that the new machine came with a full Snow Leopard install. One short hour later, and I was back in business. Now, what really saved me was my buddy Ron's backup feeds to Dropbox script. I ran that yesterday afternoon, so I was able to open the backed up version on the old machine, finish writing the show notes while the new machine got the fresh install of the OS on the solid state drive. I haven't done any timing tests to see whether it's even faster. I'm not sure it will be for the operations that I was testing. But bottom line, I am absolutely delighted with my new machine. And thank you, Steve, for my birthday present. Well, Honda Bob asked me to make sure you guys knew something really interesting about his service that he provides. You may think that you can't call Honda Bob while your car is still new because it's still under warranty. Well, if something actually breaks on your under warranty car, you definitely don't want to call Honda Bob because he's going to charge you for his labor. You definitely have to take it back to the creepy dealer to get it fixed. But there's a lot of stuff you do when a car is new, the normal service, right? Oil changes and brakes and all the kind of stuff that's not covered under warranty, that's just the normal service of, you know, the new baby checkup kind of stuff, you can actually have Honda Bob do that kind of work. So instead of going to the creepy dealer, have him come over to your house, do it on your schedule while you relax in your easy chair, or heck, like we learned last week, maybe you give him your keys and let him do it when you're not even there. So try giving Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com or visit his fantastic website at hdabob.com. Honda Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. So I'm thinking the whole internet might just slow down this Tuesday. Microsoft has matched its largest security bulletin of all time with 17 bulletins, 19 of which are considered critical and the rest as important. The bulletins cover everything from XP to Server 2003 to Vista to Server 2008 to Windows 7. But wait, that's not all. You get critical security updates to Office XP 2003, 2007, and 2010. Don't let the Mac people feel left out, though. We get critical security updates for 2004, 2008, and 2011. Heck, if you're only using the OpenXML file format converter for Mac that gives you cross-version compatibility, there's still a critical update for you, too. Let's say you're just running the viewer software for any of the Office products. Don't feel left out. There's a critical software update for that, too. So, you know, go run your updates. One more security light topic. If you run any WordPress installations, run over and update them to version 3.1.1. You don't have to do that if you don't want to. But, you know, if you don't do it, you're just leaving yourself open to allow an attacker to conduct cross-site request forgery attacks, conduct cross-site scripting attacks, or, you know, cause a denial of service condition. I mean, I'd only update if any of those things matter to you. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this week we have Kershen from FreeRangeCoder.com. How are you today, Kershen?
Oh, doing great. Thank you, Allison.
Oh, this is so fun. We've been wanting to do this for a long time. I got to tell you, I searched Google Maps for about a half hour trying to find a pond between us. And we were thinking the Great Salt Lake, but that's kind of up a little high for a direct line to Iowa, to California. Lake Mead, I think, is
Lake
as close
Mead. Yeah, I think I must have flown over that on the way back.
Possibly the Colorado River, maybe.
That'll count.
I think so. It turns out the rules are not that rigid on this as we once thought. So. So the reason I wanted to get you on was because you and I have gotten in some interesting conversations about women in technology. And one of the things that I'm intrigued by is I know a lot of adult technical women, tons of them at work, tons in podcasting, no shortage in any way that I can find. But I don't find young women in technology. You know, we have a lot of young men in the podcasting land writing scripts and being all geeky with us and stuff. But young women, I don't find. And so I know you've been pretty involved in the community about this sort of thing. So I thought it might be fun to have you on. Yeah. But maybe we should get a little background on you first and figure out how you got into this thing.
Yeah, well, I'm currently working in a pretty large avionics company as a systems engineer. We've got two divisions, and I'm in the commercial systems division. So I specify and work on advanced prototypes for things on the flight deck. Our group's called the Advanced Concepts Group, and I get to play with a lot of toys, especially commercial technology like touch screens. We're trying to get an iPad. takes time. But I did get a nice 8-core Mac Pro for the lab. So
nice.
Yes, came in last week. So that was pretty neat. And so I just to see where we can prototype and bring in technology to help pilots in the cockpit so they can operate safer and understand more about their surroundings, whether they're mountains or buildings or towers and so on. Just let people fly safer and complete their mission successfully. So we're looking at a short time frame, probably 2 to 5 year time frames. We'll be looking at amazingly interesting things such as a synthetic vision, which essentially paints a picture of the world that the pilot would be able to see. Could they see outside? If you're in your clouds, you really can't see outside. But if we knew where you were and we had the geographical information about all the mountains, we could draw the mountains and you could, pilots could look at that and say, ah, yes, you know, there's a mountain over there. We should not go that direction.
Because we know where the plane is in 3D space, and we know where the stuff is on the ground, so marrying those two together.
Yeah. It's almost, and when I have kids come in, and I get a lot of students from the local schools come in, I would tell them, oh, look, you know, it's you might have seen this before yesterday on your Nintendo Wii or your PlayStation 3 when you're playing all these virtual worlds. Technology is the same, except we're now using it to help pilots. Yeah.
Very cool. That sounds like fun work. So what's your educational background?
Well, got a Bachelor of Sciences from Singapore, and that's in computer science and mathematics. It's Singapore is a little tiny nation state, and I remember you had an episode that talked about Singapore. I downloaded that. It's just above north of the equator, and I did my bachelor's in, as I said, computer science and mathematics, a three-year degree because it's the English system rather than a four-year degree. Everything's compressed. You did three subjects in your first couple of years and two in the final year. So I did computer science, physics, which gave me an incredible sense of interest about the physical world, and mathematics. So...
Physics gave me an incredible sense of humility. Is what that
this is true. This is true.
Quantum mechanics, it gets real weird if you go far enough out there. I took 5 quarters of physics because that way I could take less chemistry. It just gets really bizarre out there. And I wasn't even into the total weird stuff, but definitely strange land.
This is true. I remember my quantum physics course. Oh, boy, that was fun. Yeah. and then I worked for the Singapore University teaching as a full-time teaching assistant, which is great because I love interacting with students. And, you know, that's the quickest way to learn is to go teach something. But you stay about 3 chapters ahead.
Because you've really got to know the material. You can't just fake it right?
This is true. And then I applied for and got into the University of Texas at Austin to do a master's in computer sciences. And I decided that after doing the master's to try to continue on to the PhD. And my interest was in computer graphics, because back then computer graphics was slowly a field that was coming into being. And I remember in 92, perhaps, I was up at SIGGRAPH, the Society Special Interest Group for Graphics, up in Dallas.
Right.
And they were had featured a couple of Pixar's first shorts. Yeah, you remember the one with the bee and Andre? Yeah, they showed They showed that then. And they showed something which I thought was really hilarious. It was something that a bunch of people at MIT had done. It was an intermix between... traditional cell animation with CGI.
Right, you draw by hand.
And stuff that was computer animated. It was called Grinning Evil Death. Search for that on YouTube, folks. It's worth watching. After watching that one, and I just did a web search, and we've come full circle. The gentleman that did from MIT that did Grinning Evil Death also did those advertisements from Charles Schwab with the paint, you know, the people that looked as if they were painted.
Oh, I love those ads. Yeah. They just look like real people, but there's something that just draws your attention, doesn't it?
And he has an iPod app too. It's called, this company's called Flat Black Films. And he has an app which I really, really enjoy. It's for mind mapping, but 3D.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, it's cool.
I like a good mind mapping application.
Yeah, this one's kind of fun. It's not terribly expensive. And it is called Headspace. 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 And came full circle for me. It's like,
I got to go check that out.
So I've always loved to learn. I always love to teach. And solving problems, what all good engineers do. And wound up being a
PA. Can't help ourselves, right?
Yeah, there you have it. And I'm also very, very interested in computer-human interaction as well. And that includes, interactions with respect to pilots flying planes. We've laid so much complexity on the cockpit that sometimes we have to sit back and say, how do we make it easy for the pilots to know what's happening right now?
Yeah. Right, because if you have a slip of the mind for just a moment, there's an awful lot of complexity in
there,
right?
That's true. Yeah.
So now, what kind of computers do you run in your house there?
Well, we're almost, but not quite, almost a complete Mac household. We have 6 Macs and 2 Windows laptops. I blush to mention those two because the one of them's only used for one purpose, and that's to load data on little cartridges that we put in our little plane. Oh, did I mention I'm also a pilot? It helps in our job.
Oh, yeah. Nice. That explains the interest there.
In flying. It marries the two parts that I really like. Flying.
So you actually have a flight data recorder?
No, actually, this is a GPS on the plane that I need to load. We need to load flight data for every 56 to 28 days because things change. And approved landing procedures and so on change. And we have to keep up to date. And the company which makes the data loader has not made one for the Mac. And we didn't want to tempt fate with parallels either.
It's not something you want to mess with and perhaps get it wrong.
Yeah, so every time we boot up that computer, it says it's got 28 quazillion updates, you know. So we spent
more
time
till next week.
I heard.
What is it? 17 bulletins?
Something it's gonna be like it's gonna that. Be I know.
Fun. I think the internet's gonna slow down with all those getting uploaded, right? Downloaded.
We at work we're a complete complete Windows shop and having that Mac in the lab really makes a delightful change.
Yeah. Oh boy, I'd give my eye teeth. So how about let's get on to women in technology now. So we see how you got in there. I did want to mention, you said that your father was a big influence as
Yes, that's right. He was my main driving motivation to get into this business. His background is in electrical engineering, so we joke that he does high power stuff, you know, back when he's retired now. He used to work for the utilities back home, laying cables, putting in street lights and, you know, figuring out where to put street lights and so on. So a varied amount of varied jobs back when he was with the electrical company in Singapore. And he motivated me, made me memorize my times table when I was very small, and helped me with math and all that sort of stuff, and encouraged me to get into technology. Even bought me, get this, bought me an Apple II, not a 2 Plus, not a 2GS, an Apple II back in 1979.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, I not to ask you your age, but how old were you when you had your first computer?
1979, I would have been 18.
Oh, wow.
Everybody else, do the math.
Well, luckily, I can't do subtraction, so I can't do it. But I was fine. I didn't calculate math tables. I did skip that.
Yeah. Yeah.
First experience with a calculator was in 1976. That was when my dad got an HP reverse Polish notation calculator. And and he was a huge influence on me, too. I mean, he was a mechanical engineer, and it was sort of a given that I was going to be an engineer. I never had a moment's doubt about the whole thing.
There you have it. Yeah. Yeah, I lusted over HP calculators. A friend of mine had a lovely 29 or something back then, and finally got one. Now I have 4.
You know, there's a nice app for the iPhone for the I favor the 11C.
Oh, you favor the 11C? Personally favor the 16C. I don't have that here with me.
Isn't that one of the financial ones?
No, the 16C is the only computer science in the same form factor that you have. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
HPmuseum.org if people want to go visit.
Now, Steve got the 15C because he insisted on having imaginary numbers, but I don't believe in them, so I went with the 11.
You have it. Well, the one I have on my iPhone is HP 42S.
And, you went for the 42. That 42. Was the one with, or the 41 CV was the one with the little tape cartridges that went
in.
You
could put them in, and they used it on Space Shuttle, in fact. Yeah. That's why I
we're never
going
to get to the subject if we keep having this much fun.
Yeah.
Good, 12 minutes and we haven't actually started the plot yet, have
we? All right, the plot thickens.
All right, let's talk about women in tech.
Right. I'm pretty much fortunate at work. In fact, it seems weird to me that not too many women actually... The national survey say about 12% of engineers are women, but I see a large number of them, and get this... Pretty you know, younger women as well. We're talking people in their 20s and 30s. So at work, we believe it's about 12%, but I bump into them frequently.
Everywhere?
No.
I still see a lot more women in software engineering. Mm-hmm. It's very high. Our vice president, or our director, who has about 1,200 employees, she's a woman, and a lot of her department managers are women. But in mechanical engineering, I still don't see as many.
Yeah.
Double E? Seems like more in double E.
More in double E. I see a few in mechanical and quite a few in industrial. We even have a chemical engineer at work that works in material science as well, you know, making of parts and things. Yeah. But here's the best part. The senior VP of engineering, which is reporting directly to the president and CEO, is a woman.
Okay. There you go. So plenty of role models around, that's for sure. Right?
Yep. Certainly. One thing which draws a lot of women in technology is it's a neat field. You still have to work at it, though. You know, and anything worth time and doing a good career, you'll have to get expertise, knowledge, and training. But the best part is the salaries are reasonably high compared to non-technical fields. I did a quick search and found that starting salary is around the 50K region, which is pretty good.
There's quite a variation depending on which it is.
If you can stand
chemical engineering, it starts at 85.
Because of the great demand in that.
Then there's chemistry involved, so I'm out on that
same
one.
Here.
The other thing I like to tell people is that the nice thing about engineering is you can be a mediocre engineer and make really good money. You know, so a lot of disciplines, you know, kids are always saying, well, I want to be a basketball star. Okay, like 0.05% of the people who decide to do that make any money.
Yeah.
Same thing with acting, you know, so many different careers. You've got to be the number one or, you know, in the top 5% to make a lot of money. But in engineering, pretty much everybody makes good money. I mean, you can make more money if you're amazing, but you can be mediocre and do pretty darn well.
Yeah, you can be entry level and get a reasonably good job. And on top of that, engineering and technology, the degree gets you not only into the engineering position, but also opens up many career options. This may surprise you, but we've had women engineers transition from a pure engineering position into a legal, for example. There's a legal counsel at work whose background is in mechanical, I believe. And then we have somebody in our corporate development group who was recently got an MBA, but she was doing, you know, systems engineering for many years before transitioning to different positions in the field.
You know, that's a great point. I slid across from mechanical engineering into information technology,
and
having my engineering background really helps me in supporting the engineers.
Sure, it gives you this rigorous way of going through and getting problems solved and understanding how engineers go about their business. I think it really opens a lot of opportunities. So, and there was another engineer I met just the other day. She moved into contracts.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So you had a note in the show notes, and I really want to highlight that point you were going to make, but I'll steal it from you because I'm reading it first, that moving to a legal career with an engineering background, you're prepared with logical reasoning and research.
Yeah, this is
a really good marrying
This is true because, in fact, that's what that lady said. The lady was now a legal counsel. She said, you know, I was one leg up over all the other people in the class because, you know, of my engineering background. I've been doing a lot of research. I know where to look for papers. You know, I have a very solid way of looking at problems and understanding where to get the facts, how things supported other things. So, it was really helpful.
My father ended up doing a lot of patent law because of his engineering background. Then he got an interest in legal, and he had a whole slew of patents on his own. And the combination, that made him really, really valuable, too. You got more money because of that.
Yeah,
that was
this
a nice
is true.
Combo.
Patents are fun. Yeah. I have some.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
about seven. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I actually filled out a patent disclosure form once, but I didn't ever submit it. So.
Yeah, we're really encouraged at work. Everything is sort of database driven, so you can enter your thoughts, and then some people come back and say, this looks patentable. Okay. Go work with the patent attorney.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We really invest a lot in our, people's ideas and innovations. So. lots of fun.
I think another thing people don't realize is how many other technical fields engineering applies to.
Oh, it's up and coming. For example, just down in the University of, down the road in the University of Iowa, which is about 20 miles, 30 miles south of us here. They're looking into biomedical, they're looking into green engineering and so on. And a lot of little spin-off companies, part of the technology incubator out down in Iowa City. And it really opens up lots of opportunities. For example, if you're a mechanical engineer, you might even be wanting to go into green technology. We've got in town in Cedar Rapids, we have a company that makes... wind farm blades.
Nice.
So they make blades, and I think they probably put up the whole structure as well. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a great mechanical engineering
and,
area.
Also, if you go into chemical, you might want to look at biomass, fuel extraction and stuff like that, and getting better ethanol from the corn that we grow and so on. So, yeah. Yeah.
Now, another thing, speaking about women in technology, one of the advantages of having women in technology is the diversity of thought is what you need in order to create good products.
I think that's really important.
My company's just huge on diversity, and they're not huge on diversity because, oh, it's like good, nice to be, good to be nice to people and all that kind of crap. It's like, no, we're going to come up with better products if we have diverse opinions. If you get a bunch of people that all think alike, you're only going to come up with one thing. But if you have people who think differently of different cultures, different races, all, everything you can be different about, different genders, you get better ideas.
Sure. In fact, I think it's been proven that diverse teams really perform better. Many of the times that we're looking at work, for example, looking at new products and so on, we not only call in the engineers, we call in people from marketing, call in people from sales, from the advanced
group. You guys are crazy.
Yeah.
We don't go that far.
Well, the idea is, you might get some ideas and then people join and say, hey, why don't you think about this? It's really getting people to come up and throw in ideas and so on, and that really, really helps. Not just engineering or not just marketing throwing things across. Hey, why don't you guys look at this? Everybody sits in and collaborates, and that really helps. Difference of opinions, difference of ideas, viewpoints, backgrounds, and then the most important thing is that they'll different people in the group might be able to catch ideas which catch issues which are missed and may be able to suggest ideas that you've never thought of.
Definitely.
That's a big plus. Yeah.
So what would you suggest to young women today looking into this field? Are there ideas you have for how they can get involved to get excited about this?
Well, the key thing is problem solving again. I think girls tend to be more socially oriented. They tend to come together and solve a problem. Communications are important, relationships. So how do we leverage technology to solve problems versus looking at technology as an end to itself? We'll take that and do something that would help perhaps build better water filtration systems, for example. In fact, one of the other podcasts I listened to, and I
wait, you listen to another show?
Yes, I do. It's called the World Technology Podcast, put out by BBC America WGBH, I believe, up in Boston. I need to check this out, but it's really good. They cover technology as it applies to making, for example, very cheap stoves for that can be deployed in Duffer and so on, water filtration systems, how people could use an egg whisk and make a centrifuge, things like that.
Jeez, cool.
And it's worth listening to. So it tends to be a very innovative use of technology in different parts of the world. So that's a really good podcast I listen
to. That's very cool.
Yeah. And for girls... to get connected, one thing a lot of people talk about is to look for networking opportunities. And a lot of organizations out there, a lot of professional organizations like the Society of Women Engineers. There's one called the AAUW, which I found, which is the American Association for University Women. And I've got links that can go into the show notes that talk a bit about this. And the first thing is to just find if there's any of these organizations that you can join, either at work or even if you're in university. These organizations tend to be in university as well.
They've even gotten involved in the at the high school level. My daughter got a scholarship or an award or something like that from the Society of Women Engineers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She ended up going into biochem, but that's cool too.
As engineering. There you go. Yeah. So there's several levels, I think. The first one is you want to get together and learn and meet other people of like persuasion, other engineers. So social networking would be the first degree of contact.
So that's a way to be social. Yeah. That is our natural instinct and mm-hmm. yet still be in the technical field.
Yeah. Just to find out other people, find out what they're interested in, hang out together, watch a movie, things like that. And then this progresses on. I think the next thing you want to do in developing your skills, first thing you want to do is start learning. There might be opportunities at work, and that's pretty much stressed at the place I work at. Mentor programs are pretty important where you, and I participate in that myself. I actually have a mentor that's out of my field. He works in marketing, because I really want to know how marketing decides what it is engineers go bill, you see. So
that's an interesting idea to get a mentor outside of your field. Mm-hmm. I had never thought of that. Mm-hmm. I'd always kept mine within engineering or within IT.
Yeah, just get out, go find a different realm, and that builds your skills and knowledge about what other people are doing. Sort of a belonging thing to me. The more I know,
helps. And that is important to us too, right?
Yeah. And then
you mentioned STEM a few times.
Yes, that's right.
And I've heard of it, but I don't really know what STEM is.
STEM actually stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It's an abbreviation used by a lot of educators to refer to trying to teach kids or getting courses put together for students to build them up so that they can transition into courses when they go to university with respect to engineering.
So it's for the high school, or what level is it for?
It's more of a term that says, oh, you want to do technology and mathematics. Here are the courses you need to take a look at. If you want to go into engineering, you got to have a basis in STEM. So it's an abbreviation that essentially connotes science, technology.
Just interest in the subject and getting people
together to support teaching about STEM. And I'm really passionate about that.
They have contests and things for schools, don't they?
Yeah, oh, quite a few. The biggest one is of course the first, which was started up by Dean Kamen, the famous Segway man. I got to meet him once. Because the company sponsors quite a lot of US FIRST. FIRST stands for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology, and they sponsor a lot of contests and tournaments worldwide.
If you want to get anybody interested in technology, have them just sit down and watch our videos of Dean Kamen, and you just want to go do what he does. I mean, for the Segway, but he's done stuff with water filtration systems. Mm-hmm. He's done... I got to see him speak at the All Things Digital conference, and he spoke about a bionic arm they created for soldiers having lost their arms. Mm-hmm. And it is one of the most compelling, amazing, he's so cool what he does. Yeah. He was also, a friend of mine worked for him, and I think he might still work for him. And they were working on a portable dialysis machine.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know if they ever did that, but where you wouldn't have to go get stuck in the hospital for 5 hours a day getting dialysis. You could cart it around.
Yeah, I might have heard of that also on the World in Technology podcast. So, yeah, it's amazing. But what FIRST sponsors are three major competitions each year to help.
Oh, wait a minute! You just jumped subjects here. You just said FIRST, and that's you define that?
Yeah, it's for Inspiration and Recognition of Science and Technology. That was Dean Kamen's organization.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't make that connection that FIRST is from him. And again, I've heard of FIRST, but I don't really know much about it either.
Yep. Link in the show notes as well. And our company sponsors FIRST as a strategic partner. And the one I got involved last year was the FIRST LEGO League as a referee. It's really high power, high energy, excitement from the kids. These are elementary school kids. They get to play with Lego, and I don't.
Oh, you just cool have to Lego. Watch them.
Yeah, and it's just amazing the innovations they come up with. There's a game board that has different Lego pieces all over, and everybody's got the same game board. And they have to build a robot and program it by themselves, with maybe supervision to tell them what they need to do. But the programming and the construction of the robot is up to the students. And they have a 2.5 minute round that they let the robot loose, and it's supposed to perform several challenges. Tasks on this game board. Yeah. And
wow.
And the thing is, it teaches the kids about... This year's focus was on biomedical engineering, so it's called Body Forward. So you had to put a stent into a simulated heart or put a patch on it, bring a biomedical engineer and a doctor to the patient. So the robot had picked different mini Lego figurines up and bring them over across to the other side.
Even though they're playing with Legos, it gets them thinking about the bigger picture of what they're trying to solve.
Yeah.
Wow.
Next year's will actually be on food. And I forget exactly what the title was, but next year they're going to do something on food, engineering, and so on. So it's a blast.
I'm sure there's people listening right now who have daughters and sons. Mm-hmm. Definitely don't want to leave the boys out either, but maybe they can encourage them to check these programs out in their school and get them involved. Sometimes in just an early exposure, people don't know it's there until they get that kind of exposure. Kids don't know that that's a choice.
It gets people interested in thinking about technology and I can do these things by myself. And then the other challenge, the other levels for middle and high school would be to build bigger and bigger robots. And on top of that, not only do you build robots that do things, there's a part of the competition where you have to make a presentation and talk about the robot you constructed, about the challenges that you're about to face, and so on. And it also encourages teamwork and such. So at an early age, I think that's really valuable.
Oh, that does sound good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wish there'd been that when I was a kid. We didn't ever get that.
No, I didn't have that either. But I did have Lego when I was growing up.
I don't even know if that... No, I don't think Legos were really around when I was little. I always wanted an Erector set, and I never got one until I was... I think I was about 25 when a friend of mine gave me an Erector set. I always wanted a Play-Doh Fun Factory, too, and I didn't get one of those till my 18th birthday. A friend of mine gave me one. I have one right now.
I was good. I got some recently. Lego, but I haven't had a chance to go build cool stuff. I guess one of the technical things.
Actually, I wanted to do the robot thing with the kids, but I think it wasn't. There was not a Mac client at the time.
It's now available for the Mac. Bluetooth download or IR. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I need to get one of those.
Amazon.com. I've seen the price. I'm lusty.
Oh.
back to level. So you get social and networking, and then you start learning, and then I think, as you mature as an engineer, you want really to be a force of change, not only in the company, but also in your community and society as a whole. You know, you've got all this knowledge and stuff. How could you help your community develop itself and get better? So I'm really passionate about building bicycling. I get the bike to work a couple of times a month. So I'm going to get started when the weather gets better. But also to spread the word around getting more trails and so on in the town. So it's where you become a force for change. And I think that's pretty important, especially after so many years, you have new and upcoming engineers. Just don't want to make sure, you don't want to make them fall in the same pitfalls that you encountered as you were.
I started a mentoring blog at work for that same reason. I've got a whole series called Mistakes I Have Made.
Yep, never be afraid to say, oops, made a mistake there. Because
one of my favorites was, I did a whole segment on people aren't just like you. And it sounds really obvious. Of course people aren't just like you, but I didn't know that in my heart until I was probably 35. I remember the exact day I found it out that somebody wasn't just like me and didn't have the same motivations, wasn't excited by the same things that excited me. And it was like this epiphany. By blogging about it, I thought, okay, maybe I can teach some people this a little earlier
That's true. Yeah. Yeah, there's so many
things. So what about limitations as women? Do you find much of that?
Well, apart from not being able to lift extremely heavy objects, not at all, really. You know, women have made inroads into all fields in technology. I know, this is amazing fact. One of the lead, in fact, the chief test pilot in Boeing, I believe, is a woman. Or at least was when I last looked.
But I think there still are organizations where you'll hit a glass ceiling.
Yeah.
And I think the advice I would give there is if you do run into it, and I'm the kind of person that I always look to see if it was my fault first. Mm-hmm. And I ended up working in an organization for about 11 years that I was never going to go anywhere in that organization. Mm-hmm. And after I left, I realized that out of 273 engineers, I was the last woman to leave. I looked around and went, wait, everybody else figured this out faster than me, that this was not a place.
No, I should keep plugging on. Maybe
I'm just not good enough, that kind of thing. And I went on to great things after I left. Mm-hmm. But I guess the advice would be if you do run into it and you're sure it's not you, then leave. Go someplace else not normal anymore. It used to be normal, but it is not normal.
Yeah, you can always get a second opinion. If you have a mentor, you could bounce ideas off them. Yeah.
Yeah, well, after I left, my best friend said, "Geez, what took you so long? We all knew that." I was like, "Oh, well, why didn't you tell me?" Yeah, nobody ever said you're never going to go anywhere because they're a bunch of chauvinist pigs. But I don't want to imply that's prevalent.
No.
It's the other way around.
No.
It's not prevalent. No. And if you run into it, then maybe try to change it. Mm-hmm. But then if you can't, just get out of there and go someplace else because there are most places are good now, I think.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. I think with diversity and so on, companies are becoming to understand and everybody's opinions are valued. So.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Now, what about in school? I know girls sometimes don't want to be smart.
Yeah, it's one of those things which is really hard to change with peer pressure and so on. So one of the things that I really enjoy about the company is that we will bring in 8th grade girls every year during Engineering Week, which I believe is sometime in February. And we bring all these 8th grade girls and... we have a really good community relations team and they would survey the girls before they came, ask them, do you know anything about the company? What's your idea about engineering and so on? And then survey them after. And there's a mark change between before and after. They
about
would say
attitude,
before, you know, I have no idea. I think your company builds planes. No, we don't. But you make bombs. No, we don't either. But after that, they say, oh, yeah, I now know a lot more about what you do. And I now know what it takes to be an engineer. And indeed, I'm interested in being an engineer. So
really?
It really helps their sense of well-being. And it's peer pressure at that age usually.
That part never bothered me. Mm. So I have to put my people aren't just like you hat on to try to figure out why that would bother other girls. And I mean, there's so much pressure to fit in and to be cool and to be popular. And you don't get that by, competing in the math contest.
That's true.
My daughter was lucky enough to be in a group of kids who were highly, highly competitive about mm-hmm. grades. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't matter if you were a boy or a girl. They were all fighting like, what'd you get? Dang it. Kevin got 2 points more than me on the math test. I'm gonna beat him next time. And that competitive spirit really helped.
Yeah, it sounds like Singapore. Competition is really, really big. Yeah.
Yeah, but, I do like that.
I know, but we try. We encourage young women. We have things at work where we would have job shadows that would come in for a day to look at what you're interested in, what it might be interested in doing. So follow you around for a day, and I always try to ask for young girls to come in so I can show them that engineering is not sitting behind a desk and working with slide rules.
Oh, okay.
Slide rules. What are those?
Hey, don't be mocking slide rules. Since my dad had that first calculator, I was still on a slide rule.
Don't knock slide rules, because I have my dad's 1956 slide rule at work, just to remind
I have my dad's slide rule at work, too.
Oh, wow.
I love it. It's got his Michigan State University. It has the name of the dorm he was living in the time carved into it, so he wouldn't lose it.
I think he wrote that inside, too. I still have the case for it. And a PDF manual somewhere.
Every once in a while, I sit down and try and use it, and I can't remember, and I have to look it up on Wikipedia, and I teach myself how to, you know, I can get to where I can add, but I mean, I used to have to do, logarithms on it, and that was rugged stuff. Hairy.
Well, there are also outreach activities that you can go to schools and help them give presentations on engineering and so on. So the company does sponsor that. So that's really a
good. Okay. So that's, they've got programs for you to go out. That's part of your community outreach.
Yep, definitely.
You know, I know we do a lot of stuff for Engineers Week, and I actually have never gotten involved. And now you get me kind of inspired to help out.
Give it a whirl.
I've done a little bit. I've gone to the schools and stuff, but I think I went to the schools when my kids were really young, like second grade, and you just aren't going to make any sense to those people.
You got to get them started. I did
a presentation on some computer-aided design stuff, and I brought in a computer, and I basically showed a CAD model and showed how to make a Mickey Mouse face, right? I figured that would work, and we had music to it and everything, and I'm about halfway through it, and the kids are really with me. Man, it looks like this is going really good. And also one kid raises his hand, and I said, you know, Billy, what do you have to say? And he says, I have a parrot. What does that have to do with what I was talking about? And then all of a sudden the next kid, I have two dogs. I used to have a goat. You know, it's like, I had a headache when I left. I never went back. Oh,
you have to try things. What we do actually for these outreach things, it's very subtle. You get these gumdrops and you get toothpicks and you have them make geodesic domes.
Ooh, that's fun. I like it. I like it.
we have the coolest community outreach people at work, I tell you. Oh, man.
Going on where I work, and I'm just not looking for it. So maybe to other people who are out there, you know, look into those programs. And not just for women, for sure, for men as well, because, you know, we're slipping behind here. We gotta stay ahead on this stuff. Mm-hmm. This is where the fun work is.
That's it. You know, it's all fun. It's not all, hiding behind computers sort of thing.
Yeah. Oh, not at all, I don't think.
Yeah, in fact, one of the gals at work who's part of the community outreach, because of this Dean Kamen first thing, she got to go one of his events and one of the receptions, and she actually spotted Will.i.am and had a good chat with him.
Oh,
he was standing on the side by himself, and all the other people actually didn't know who he was. I know him.
It's funny who's rock stars in our world, right?
Yeah, I know. Just amazing.
Well, Kirsten, I really appreciate you giving us all this stuff. And like she said, she's given us about 25 different links of all kinds of ways to get involved. Oh, IT Salary Survey. I'm going to go check that one out.
A couple of those.
Your Twitter list of women in technology, fun people to follow and about first.
There you have it.
You've got... Mm-hmm. You've got some great articles in here. I really appreciate you taking the time to put all that together as well.
Definitely. Yeah, we could chat for hours, but...
Oh, I think we could. I think we talked for about a half hour before we even started.
Yeah,
here,
there you have it. Yep, yep.
We shared cats. I mean, we had all kinds of fun here. So why don't you plug freerangecoder.com? What can people see?
All right. My website is freerangecoder.com. And it's an occasional blog that I put things I've discovered with respect to the Mac, thoughts I have about programming, about technology in general. There are even a few links to a software that I've written. I did one that would display the alt tags on pictures in Safari. So that was kind
of right.
Neat.
I think I reviewed that on the show.
Yep. We covered that. And I look at it as a way to get the word out. Now, I may not get as many hits that, you know, everybody does. My hit counter probably sits at... sub 500.
Oh, you don't need to say. That's like telling people how much you weigh.
Yeah. But it's a thing. Come check it out. Freerangecoder.com. And I'm also on Twitter as Kirshen.
And spell that for them.
That's KIRSCHEN. And I'm the only one on Twitter with that name.
There you go. Well, Kirshen, again, thank you very much. This was really fun. I'm glad we finally did this.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this, and we'll catch you on the podcast.
Well, if any of you have daughters, sons, nieces, nephews, you know, people who are trying to get their kids interested in math and science, I really hope you'll send them over to listen to Kirshen talk about it, because, you know, I got more excited about what I do for a living after listening to her. So I think I'd like to get involved in some of those programs and help actually encouraging some young kids to get into science and math. We got to catch up. Well, that's going to wind things up for this week. Many thanks for our sponsors for helping to pay those ever-important bills, ScreenStep, Smile, and of course, Honda Bob. If you haven't been over to iTunes lately to push that little button for giving stars, that would be really cool if you could do that. If you could write a review, that kind of helps get the show pumped up in the ratings, that sort of thing. I'd really appreciate that. And don't forget, if you're buying something on Amazon, go through the Amazon affiliate link on my webpage, search for anything through there, and anything you buy in that session will actually go a tiny little bit of a couple of percentage points go to help fund the NoSilicast. So don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, just head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. I guarantee the NoSilla castaways will welcome you with open arms. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.